Damn, Hardman's broken his ankle again. He's probably going to want to come out of the game. Hill, get over here.
Yeah, Coach Wolf.
You're going in at inside linebacker because pretty boy Hardman won't play on a broken ankle. You've got to watch out for that center from Tech. He's been holding all day.
The center is holding?
Yeah, that's what I said.
That's so weird because in 20th century poetry class, we just read The Second Coming by Yeats. And Yeats says, things fall apart, the center cannot hold.
Yeats? Who does he play for?
Nobody. He's a poet we're studying in class.
What is this class thing that you keep mentioning?
You know, class. This is college. We go to classes where they teach us stuff.
Is that where everybody goes in the morning? There's never anybody around here.
Yes, we're at class.
Maybe I should go to one of these classes. There's some things I've been trying to figure out, like, does matter have its own intrinsic properties, or does it derive properties like mass by its interactions with an invisible, all-pervasive field, you know?
In physics, that's the Higgs field, Coach.
Higgs? The quarterback from Gowanus State?
Different Higgs, sir. Shouldn't I get in the game and do that tackling thing, Coach?
No. Let's call a timeout. I've just realized how much focus I'm putting on football when this is really an institution of higher learning. We're not playing another minute of football until I understand what stops the Higgs field from interacting with particles after they have mass, and where is the mass gained from? Meanwhile, listen to this program on college football and concussions. And now, the three-time winner of Ugliest Cheerleader in the SEC, Miss Colin McEnroe.
Thank you so much. We're going to talk about college football today. We're also going to talk a little bit about PBS's Frontline special last night on concussions. And they are interrelated in lots of different ways and in ways that really show up in particular in this book, The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football by Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan. Jeff Benedict is here with us. He's joining us from the studios of WVTF in Roanoke. A little bit later, we'll also add to the conversation Jim Gilmore. He's a producer and reporter who's worked on several dozen front lines, including last night's League of Denial, the NFL's concussion crisis. There's also a concussion-related chapter in Jeff's book, so there'll be plenty of overlap there. And by the way, the League of Denial special will re-air Friday on CPTV Sports. But I just want to say, even having watched it last night, and I'm a football fan, I'm a Green Bay Packers fan, we've actually, by happenstance, we've had a bunch of concussions this year. And of course, like what I do as a fan is I go, well, when can he come back? How soon can he come back? How soon can he get back to us? Seeing the last night's special and then reading Jeff's book, I realized that I'm not going to probably be able to look at things quite the same way that it actually, the more you know, the more it changes your focus and your perspective. And so here in Connecticut, we've also had the experience of UConn football getting off to a terrible start, firing its coach in midseason, and making me wonder more, not for the first time, whether we ever should have added big-time college football to the UConn diet. Not a kind of toothpaste you can get back in the tube very easily, but you do wonder. So all of those questions are mulling around. We'd love to hear from you as we go along. We're live here in the afternoon. The number is 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Jeff Benedict, this is sort of not your first trip to the dance with writing about football and reporting about football, but this is a more in-depth look. And you know, just even to the point that I was making before, and not specific to concussions, but let's just start here. You're watching a college football game now based on what you know and what you've reported. Let's say you see some player limping off the field or being carried off the field with some kind of pretty severe injury. Once again, as a football fan, you might just be thinking, oh, I hope he can get back in the game at some point or return to the team this season. But there's a whole bunch of other questions that are raised by your reporting. What do you think when you see that player being helped off the field?
Well, I certainly don't think I hope he can get back in the game. In fact, when I watch games now, Colin, it's a very different experience than it was a few years ago. And the comparison I would make is the difference between going to a movie theater to watch a film and then going in a week later and watching the same film with 3D glasses. And your perspective and your depth is very different. You see things that were there before, but you couldn't see. And so I was at three games, in fact, this past weekend. I was at a game on Saturday, a game on Sunday, and then an NFL game Monday night. And in all three games, I watched players be helped off the field, some with more severe injuries than others. But every game that I go to, that happens. And in college in particular, you know, what I think about is that I don't think, well, I hope this guy can get back in the game. What goes through my mind is it would be nice if this guy knew how to do something else and could do something else, because there is a tremendous self-destructive aspect to the hits that occur in college football and certainly pro. And the majority, not just a slight majority, the overwhelming majority, as in more than 99% of the young men who play college football, will never earn a penny as professionals. But after 4 years of playing this game in college, they will live with, for the rest of their lives, the physical consequences of having done that in college. And it's very real for a lot of these guys, from brain and head injuries to just knees and backs and spines that don't work the way they're supposed to work.
And in terms of knowing how to do something else, one of the things that you explore in the book is the whole question of academic eligibility. And specifically, one of the things you get into are tutoring programs, these tutoring programs that take place within big-time college football programs. There's one at Missouri in particular that kind of plays a big role in your book. But before you even get into that, you just say a lot of these tutoring programs kind of don't exactly do what they're supposed to do. You've got Georgia football players sleeping through tutoring sessions and tutors who actually do the homework for South Carolina football players. Tell us a little bit about tutoring. What is, and that may be an unfamiliar thing to the average NPR listener. What kind of tutoring does college football provide?
Well, because there's such an enormous time demand on football players, and to be really clear about this, football players have more physical and time demands than any other athlete in college sports. And so their ability to actually focus in the classroom is pretty limited. So never mind, I'm not even talking about how prepared they are academically when they get there. Even the smart guys that play football have a severe disadvantage because they're so exhausted and have so little time that tutoring becomes a critical component of getting these guys through their 4 years. So all these schools have had to construct this huge apparatus to help these guys do their assignments and get through their classes. And they go to what's called a tutoring center on campus, and there's booths and all kinds of protocols. But one of the problems with the environment is you're bringing in these kind of, you know, these are young, handsome, muscular guys who are coming in, and you place them with a girl in a tutoring situation, and sometimes there's sexual banter and flirting that naturally goes on. It's kind of hard to completely control that. But in some of these situations, it gets really out of hand because of a couple of things. You have some tutors who sign up to be tutors because they want to have relationships with the athletes. Obviously, not all the tutors do that, but some of them do. And you have some athletes that go to the tutoring sessions thinking that this is an opportunity to possibly hook up with a girl. Not that they don't have girlfriends and other avenues to girls, but when you're tired and you don't really want to do this and you got a pretty girl sitting next to you in the tutoring booth, things happen. And the Missouri case that we wrote about in The System is a case that actually resulted in a criminal sexual assault where a player sexually assaulted his tutor in her bedroom at night. This same player had been having consensual sex with another tutor who was the roommate of the tutor who got assaulted. The roommate who got assaulted was actually there for all the right reasons. She wasn't there to meet athletes. She was there to earn $7.50 an hour, and she was there because she was smart and it was a good job. But she's in an environment that's sexually charged, and some of her colleagues were sleeping with players. They called this whole system friends with benefits. And so some of these girls were getting the benefit of you know, hanging out with famous athletes on campus, and the guys were getting their work done for them, and they were getting sex with tutors. The whole thing was out of hand, and then you have a good tutor who's there for the right reasons who becomes a victim.
Yeah, the local prosecutor who investigated the tutoring program said too many tutors were having sex with the athletes and really filthy conversations were going on between players and girls. It was a sexually charged environment. It was a joke, the whole tutorial situation. So, Jeff Benedict, you know, in your book, you look at that case, which resulted in prosecution and conviction. You look at a BYU case, not connected to tutoring, but involving a gang rape, which went to prosecution unsuccessfully. obviously, you look at those things because there are cases, there are records, there are arrests, there are people that you can talk to. There already is something of a record which you and your co-writer can examine and build from. Did you ever get any sense of what kind of iceberg is lying underneath that tip? In other words, in terms of particularly this area of sexual assault, which comes up a couple of times in your book. We should say, by the way, although the book takes a pretty tough look at college football, it's not a total condemnation. It also looks at some of the inspiring stories within it as well. But when looking at that, did you have a sense of how much of this you can't see compared to what you can see?
Absolutely. And I think if you take this sort of in steps, the second chapter of this book is called The Closer, and it's about girls who are hostesses when high school recruits come to a college campus for the first time on an official visit. And this is when the coaches are trying to lure these players to commit to that school. So you're talking about 17-year-old boys, basically, who come to campus. And the programs, the football programs, pair them up with beautiful women. And I say boys and women because they're not boys and girls. They're 17-year-old juveniles with 21-year-old adult women who are developed physically. They are smart, and they know what they're doing. And it's like a weekend date for these boys. And there aren't many situations in America where 17-year-old high school kids get to go on weekend dates with beautiful adult women. But it happens in big-time college football. Now, there aren't a lot of instances where there's sexual relationships on these visits, but there is some. But more importantly, there is the promise. It's the suggestion that if you sign here and come here, this is what you're going to get. And we started in chapter two with with hostesses, because this is the beginning of what is a progression in college football. Then they meet tutors who are there with them, and then they meet girls when they get to campus. There's cheerleaders. There's constantly women that are coming into the environment with these players. The problem with that is if you use women in this way so that they become like an object that is there for the use and entertainment of these players, some players, and I want to emphasize some because it's certainly not all, not even most, so we're talking about some players will get a warped perception of the role of women in this culture, and that's when you get to the situation that happened at Brigham Young University where there was a gang rape. And BYU is certainly not the only school. We rattled off a bunch of other schools where we documented similar gang rapes and sexual assaults, but we built it around that one case. And I think that, this obviously gets exaggerated even more for the guys who make it to the NFL, but there is this underlying culture, which is sort of like you need to be aware. And a lot of girls are not aware that there are some risks here when you go into this environment.
We're talking to Jeff Benedict. His book is called The System. It's an examination of college football. As we're getting ready to sort of add another voice to this conversation, let me just quickly talk about the concussion story that's in here. Now, this involves Texas Tech. It involves Mike Leach, who I have always sort of thought, college coaches are all pretty aggressive, pretty exploitive, they're alpha males. But Mike Leach, I think to some people, stands out as maybe kind of a thinking man's version of that, kind of an interesting guy. You follow him a lot in the book. This involves him and a player with whom he wasn't getting along anyway, but it was also a player who had a lot of advocates, including a father with a big-time football background. Craig James is the father of Adam James. Adam James gets a concussion. Mike Leach, who's mad at Adam James anyway, starts basically kind of punishing him for having a concussion. I'll let you pick up the story from there.
Well, the thing is that Adam James was a wide receiver on a team that was one of the best teams in the country and had a couple of other receivers that now play in the NFL and are among the best receivers in the NFL. I think that context is important because the difference here is that Adam James came from kind of a wealthy family. His father, Craig James, is an ESPN analyst and broadcaster. And he and Mike never did get along because he wasn't Mike's kind of player. Mike liked kids that were on an edge, that were willing to do anything, run through a wall, determined. And there wasn't a connect with Adam James. And there'd been numerous disciplinary issues with him not performing in practice or being late or fooling around or whatever. And then comes this thing where leading up to a bowl game, he gets a concussion in practice, sees a trainer. Mike doesn't know that he's been diagnosed with a mild concussion. All he knows is that the next day, Adam James shows up for practice late, you know, considerably late. And when he shows up, he's wearing a backward baseball cap and sunglasses and a T-shirt and blue jeans. And he's just kind of nonchalantly walking around the practice field. And it was a bit of an attention draw for other players. And it made Coach Leach mad. And he turns to his trainer and basically says, "Why is he late?" And the trainer says, "I don't know." And he says, "Why is he wearing sunglasses?" And the trainer says, "Well, it's probably because he was diagnosed with a concussion." And it's in that moment that Leach, that's how he finds out. So he wasn't told ahead of time. And he's angry because of the way he's dressed. They have a protocol when guys have injuries, including concussions. You're supposed to wear standard issued clothing by the team, and you're supposed to walk the track. And he's not doing that. And Mike's had issues before, and so he kind of, you know, he reacts, and he reacts in a way where he tells the trainer to essentially get him out of here, and he tells him to take him to a dark place and make him stand there alone. And the language is a little more colorful, but I can't say it on the air. And then he takes him and puts him in a shed off the facility and makes him stand there for about an hour and 40 minutes in the dark. And while he's in the shed, the player texts his father, Craig, and then begins what is a battle between two very strong personalities. Craig James, the ESPN guy, who is acting as a father who's angry at the way his son was treated with a concussion, and a coach who feels like, you know, I'm not gonna apologize for what I did because I didn't really do anything wrong. And his position is, I'm not the one who put him in the shed. I just told him, you know, get him out of here and take him to a dark place. The trainer did what he did. But this escalates out of control because what happens is the father is saying, look, my son had a concussion. This is no way to treat someone with a concussion. And eventually the university realizes neither of these guys are going to give ground. And once the university leadership gets involved, it becomes a legal matter, and it gets pretty ugly, and it costs Mike his job.
Yeah, we'll let you read the book to fill in the rest of the details of the story. But once again, this might be an example of a university reacting more proactively than most universities do due to concussions. And that's going to lead us pretty well into our next segment. Jeff Benedict is here for the whole show. We're going to come back to him about this. We're going to come back to him about a lot of other things in his book, The System, the Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football. Right now, we're going to take a break and then talk to Jim Gilmore about last night's Frontline special.
All the doctors say that I'll be fine, and I'll believe them when my eyes align and my pounding skull goes back.
All right, I'm thinking that a lot of you maybe saw this last night, this special on Frontlines, League of Denial, the NFL's Concussion Crisis. Joining us right now is Jim Gilmore, producer and reporter. He's worked on several dozen Frontlines, including that one. Jim Gilmore, first of all, as I said, I think before you joined us, I feel like I'll never watch football again the same way. And I almost wonder if I should watch football at all again, even though I'm a big Green Bay Packers fan. But we need to sort of explain this to people. And really, in some ways, in the Frontline report, there are kind of two scandals. One of them is what's happening to the brains of football players. And the other one is how the NFL dealt with all this. But let's start with what's happening to the brains of football players. There's a lot of really wonderful storytelling in this special, and some of it begins with the story of Mike Webster, a Pittsburgh Steelers star who clearly suffered some kind of dementia during his retirement and even actually did seek and get disability based on the notion that football had caused some kind of dementia in him, a rare admission from the NFL. But what's really interesting is this Nigerian born doctor who doesn't know anything about football, has never heard of Mike Webster, who winds up as the medical examiner after Mike Webster's dead. I'll let you pick up the story there. What did he see that surprised him?
Yeah, Dr. Bennett Omalo is his name, Nigerian born. Very interesting character. He didn't know anything about football, but he had read a little bit just beforehand about the story behind Mike Webster. When he arrives on the table, he just feels that there's something wrong here. He doesn't understand. He feels there's got to be some connection with the fact that this guy, for almost 20 years of his life, has been battering heads with other big men on the football field. And what he had heard about what had been going on with Webster during retirement, it just made sense that something was wrong there. So he decided that he wanted to take a look at the brain. And then when they took the brain out of Mike's head, it looked absolutely normal. And there was no, you know, history to go on to sort of think that there might be a problem here. But he still thought that something had to be there. Something was wrong. And so what he had done was that the head, the brain was sliced into slices, sent away to be stained to see if there were any anomalies. And, you know, some time passed before the test results came back, and some tests came back, and nothing was conclusive, and he had other tests done. And eventually he takes a look at these slides months later, and he sees something that just doesn't make sense. It's just something that you don't normally see. And what it was there's tau protein in the brain, and I'm no doctor, so I won't go into too much detail about it, but tau protein is normally in the brain. But what has happened to the tau protein was it had gone awry in Mike Webster's head. And the slides showed this very dramatic change. When somebody has Alzheimer's, tau is also seen as changing in the way the brain looks. But there's also a lot of other differences, so this was certainly not senility. And when he saw that, he said, okay, I don't know what a doctor would say, but eureka, basically. There's more to this than other people understand. And what he did was he started writing a report on what he had found, basically identifying a new disease or a disease that had never been seen in football players before, something that was very similar to what had been seen in boxers' brains after being batted around for many, many years. And so this is sort of the Webster story, which is very dramatic because Webster's family is wonderful, and Mike Webster was such, you know, a wonderful, great football player. So the story is very dramatic, but it's also sort of the beginning of the detective story, really. 2002 is when it happened, when he died. 2005 is when the report was printed in a scientific magazine. And that's sort of the beginning of the film in some ways, though the debate on concussions had really been going on from really the late 80s on.
And, you know, it is like a detective story, but it's like a Raymond Chandler, Philip Marlowe detective story where the detectives frequently are getting beat up by somebody else
who doesn't want
them to do their work. So Omalu winds up finding kind of an enemy in the NFL, does everything they can to kind of beat him back and discredit him. And we're going to have to sort of telescope this. This is a really lengthy, but I must say, spellbinding, jaw-on-chest experience watching this thing. But there's no way we can kind of cover it all. But gradually, other people get involved and kind of have the same experience. We meet later in this thing, Anne McKee, also a brain researcher, also, as unlike Omalu, a big football fan, somebody who grew up in a big football family, so not antipathetic towards football, and somebody who describes herself as somebody who relaxes by looking at slides that have pieces of brain tissue on them. She winds up doing the same thing as Omalu, and Jim Gilmore having pretty much the same experience when she tries to get her findings absorbed by the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, the common thread through this is anybody who has gone up against the NFL during these years always was immediately discredited, was always accused of having, not misunderstanding the science. It was a common thread that the NFL did not want to believe it. And they had this committee of their own that they had set up back in 1994 that had been looking at it all the way through and had been putting out report after report after report, which kept on finding that there was no problem with concussions, that if guys went back into a game after having a concussion, yet they seemed to have their wits about them again, there was no long-term damage. And for years and years and years, that's what they kept on claiming. And so when the other scientists out there, because there were a lot of other scientists who were saying, wait a minute, we're doing studies of retired football players, and that's not what we're finding. We're finding connections to depression. We're finding connections to guys who committed suicide or to drug use after playing. And yet the NFL just wouldn't believe it. And, you know, to this day, I mean, things have certainly changed a lot. And the NFL is dealing with it a lot more. But to this day, they still say there's not enough proof of causation. There's not enough proof of the prevalence of this disease, and they undercut it. When I guess one of the major reasons we did this film was because we couldn't understand why the NFL wouldn't be one of the biggest proponents of finding out what is going on and jumping on this before anybody else, because it's their talent that is at risk. And it's also, I think the NFL understands its responsibility that what they say about football, what they do about football, trickles down to the colleges throughout America, to the high school football players, and then the younger kids that are playing now at ages 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And that was one of the surprising things, and part of the debate that we thought was the most important thing to look at and to hopefully help people pursue that debate further because of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. And Anne McKee at one point in the film says, you know, it may be the case that pretty much anybody who plays football for any length of time has at least or any significant length of time, it has at least some of these changes to the brain. May see some of these tau proteins basically kind of strangling brain cells. All right, we have to take a little break here. When we come back, we want to go back to Jeff Benedict. We'll also just talk a little bit about, I mean, you could watch this thing, watch this special, read Jeff Benedict's book, and wonder whether anybody should really be playing football. So we'll talk about that when we come back from this break. Very short break for a little bit of fundraising.
The racketeers make money off him, win or lose. The advertisers use him up.
Even though our team was 0-14 this year, we've been invited to the Alan Turing Computational Linguistics Bowl based on our average GPA. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our interns, Tess Aronson and Jonathan Scranton. Voiceover help in the intro by Greg Hill. The part of Bill Curry was played by Franco Harris. On tomorrow's show, our salute to guilt. Should we have done that? Probably not. And now, back to Colin.
All right, yes, tomorrow a show about guilt. I suppose not entirely unrelated to some of the things that we've talked about so far today. With us is Jim Gilmore. He's a producer and reporter who's worked on many front lines, including last night's League of Denial, the NFL's concussion crisis, which you can see again on Friday on CPTV Sports. Jeff Benedict is with us. He's the author of The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football, joining us from the studios of WVTF. That's in Roanoke. I'm going to talk to both of you about this right now. I'm going to start with you, Jeff Benedict. One of the chapters in your book is called The Wounded. And it really gets into the whole question of how many injuries there are in college football and what kind of safety net exists for these so-called student athletes or athlete students. I think you said somewhere it's probably a better characterization of what they are. But, you know, we're not just talking about concussions here. We're talking about a whole range of injuries. And actually, one of the things you and your co-writer found out was, unlike the NFL, which actually has some pretty hard and fast rules about what you have to tell people about injuries, some college systems, you can't even really find that much out in some of the conferences about how many injuries there are.
Yeah. And so, Colin, what we did was we took last year. So this is a snapshot. It's not a scientific study. But we took last year, 2012, just the season, and we tracked the season-ending injuries that we were able to find. And we documented 282 players who sustained season-ending injuries from the major conferences just last year. Now, those are the ones that you can prove or ascertain through documentation. We knew of others that we had actually witnessed that weren't counted in those statistics. The bottom line is that there are a lot of college football players being carted off the field on a regular basis every weekend, and who will not return to action, at least not that year. There's a lot of carnage and collateral damage that are sustained by these players. Now, some of these are concussions, obviously, and injuries to the head, but a lot of these are injuries to the knees and the joints. In fact, the knee injury is the most common, which shouldn't be surprising, because when a helmet is the point of contact to a young man's knees, and it's, that helmet is being worn by a 285-pound missile who's coming at him, you can just imagine the kind of damage that's done to these guys.
You know, it's one thing about this is, though, it's not employment. In other words, if I'm on the job and my knees are hurt so bad, or my shoulders are hurt so bad, or I have cervical damage. I have something wrong with me that, you know, for the next 10 years, I can't get out of bed unassisted. I can seek various kinds of compensation. I can seek disability payments. There's a bunch of things that I can do. A student athlete's in a different position. So, Jeff Benedict, what kind of safety net is there for that kind of athlete? I mean, you did talk to people who 10 years after their college careers are unable to do basic daily tasks without assistance because of injuries they sustained.
That's right. And the thing here is, while they're in college, they are taken care of. And in fact, they have access to great doctors and medical facilities and hospitals. It's while they're there, that's fine. And it's good in that respect. The problem is when football is over, and the overwhelming majority of these guys will not go on to play in the NFL, and yet they live with the consequences of these injuries. And at that point, there isn't anybody there. And guys literally, you know, that can't get out of bed or have the reoccurring headaches and joint aches and pain that requires medication, therapy, doctor's visits, hospitalization. And these guys are on their own. And I think that that's where you get to the question of, you know, do we compensate college football players? Because it's one thing to talk about paying them while they're playing. It's another thing to talk about, well, what about when they're not playing, but they're racking up bills that are related to when they did?
You know, Jim Gilmore, I'm going to come back to you. This is at the end of the documentary, the Frontline documentary. This is one of the things that really gets talked about a lot. And once again, we have the spectacle of this fascinating woman, Dr. Ann McKee, who keeps examining these brains of younger and younger football players and football players who haven't spent 17 years in the NFL, you know, who are either college players, in some cases, at least in one case, a high school player. And every time she says, I was shocked. I didn't expect to see these tau protein changes that suggest this chronic traumatic encephalopathy in this young a player. And the question kind of looms over the documentary. It was raised a few years ago, or I guess maybe this year, by President Obama, who said, if I had a son, I'd have to think long and hard before I let him play football. So, Jim Gilmore, where do you come away about? Is this a fundamentally unsafe sport that practically nobody should be playing?
I think we all come away from it that change is absolutely necessary. I don't think anybody thinks that football is going to go away. But I think change has to happen with the game, and I think parents and kids have to be aware of the potential damage due to all this. This is a dangerous game, and, you know, we talked to a lot of football players, and everybody talks about, you know, when you're on the sideline of a football game, college, but especially NFL, the size of these guys that are playing, the speed and the talent that these guys have, and how hard they hit. It's been estimated that the collisions that take place time and time again are equal to the force of being in an auto accident going around 35 miles an hour into a brick wall. So of course you're going to have effects, you know, on knees and ankles, but also on brains. One of the things that Frontline is doing, you know, on our website, is they're tracking concussions this year, so they're really being carefully seeing exactly what's going on every week with every team to get a better understanding of just, you know, how big a problem this still is. At this point, I think the latest numbers, there's been 36 concussions so far, and we're only like five games into the season. And if I can mention also that the website, the PBS Frontline website, viewers or listeners can also watch this film. We put all our films up on the website, and it will be there for a good amount of time.
It does seem like the players are talking about it more. JerMichael Finley from the Packers had a concussion this year, and he did kind of a video about what that was like, what he saw afterwards, what he was worried about, what scared him. I think he described looking over at the sidelines, and he could only see bodies. He couldn't see heads. There's an incredibly frightening description in your film in which Lee Steinberg, the agent for Troy Aikman, is sitting in an examining room with him after a concussion, and they have the same conversation over and over again, and Aikman is not aware of the fact that every 5 or 10 minutes he asks the same questions. But, you know, I mean, I just wonder how much it really can be fixed. It is, I'm going to ask both of you about this, but I'll stay with you on this, Jim Gilmore, for a second. It is a violent sport. As you guys point out, the actual opening credit sequence for Monday Night Football concludes with two helmets banging together and exploding. You know, it's really the thing that it's so intrinsic to why people watch it.
I mean, the violence has always been something that has attracted viewership, no doubt about it. They don't use those helmets anymore. I think they learned that lesson. But yeah, violence is part of the game, and it's part of the game that is almost impossible to take out of the game. What these doctors and pathologists also found is that the ones possibly at the greatest risk here are the guys on the line, the guys that are every single play knocking their heads into each other. You don't have to have concussions. You just have to have repetitive hard hits to the head over a period of years to do the damage. And then you're not going to see the damage for maybe a decade, maybe two decades. And the questions that are still out there about how many hits or genetics involved with it, or is there a combination of things that cause someone to be more susceptible, none of that is really known as of yet. And that's the danger, is that that we don't quite understand how much a problem this actually might be.
You know, Jeff Benedict, your book encompasses a broader critique of college sports. It's not obviously just the injuries, not just the concussions. It's things about the environment itself, including some of the things we've talked about today, with young men being wooed by this hostess system that sounds like it's something out of a Margaret Atwood novel. These phalanxes of beautiful women who are used to woo young men there, and young men often getting into various kinds of trouble once they are there. Just the incredible confluence of physical violence and money all wrapped up together and worth billions of dollars. Knowing what you know now, imagine a 17 or 18-year-old young high school star whom you were very fond of, somebody that you liked, a family friend, whatever, thinking about entering one of these programs. What would you say to him? I mean, it's a chance to become part of something really exalted, but you're so aware of the dangers now. What would you say to that guy?
Well, here's the thing for me, Colin. When I worked on this book with Armin, when we were working on the system, I met a couple of young men like that. And when I met them, they were the subjects of our reporting. An example comes to mind, Kyle Van Noy, who's an All-American senior linebacker at BYU now. He will be in the draft in the spring. I shadowed Kyle for a year. His teammate, Ziggy Ansah, another young man from BYU who's now with the Detroit Lions, he was the fifth overall pick in the spring draft. And I got pretty fond of these two guys while shadowing the BYU team. I didn't know them when we started. Now I do. And honestly, I think about that all the time when I talk to them, because I think about like where they're going. I remember the last game I covered with them for the system was a bowl game in San Diego, and it was played in the stadium where the Chargers play their home games. And there's a poster inside the locker room about concussions. And it warns them of the dangers of the game. Now, that wasn't for them. It was for the Chargers. But the point is they will be in a locker room like that for the rest of their career. And so, you know, if it's my sons, you ask the question, would you want your son to play? For me, that I don't have to think long and hard like the president. There's no way I want my sons playing this game. Not when they're 10, not when they're 16, certainly not when they're adults, not with what I know. And I think that's the thing, when you have a young man that you really do care about and you think about, and Ziggy Ansah and Kyle Van Noy are smart guys. They've got really good brain power. You know, they're smart kids. They're not just good football players. They're smart guys. And now they're going into this environment where, you know, people say we need to change the game. You can't change this game. Football is linemen lining up opposite each other and plowing into each other on every play. You can't have football without that component. You can't fix that with helmets and safety. That's fundamental to the game. And so I think where we're at is, do we want to continue to have this game, knowing what we know? And of course, so many people like it that it's hard to kind of fathom the idea that this could go away. But the point is it's not going to get any better.
You know, I'm just first going to thank Jim Gilmore from Front Lines and from the Special League of Denial, the NFL's concussion crisis. If you didn't see it on last night's broadcast, you can see it in CPTV Sports on Friday. Jeff Benedict, we've only got about 2 minutes left, and this is like a one-hour conversation. But very quickly, because, I mean, I'm looking at it with UConn right now. One of the points you guys make in the book is, I may have the numbers wrong, but it's like 22 out of 120 major college football programs actually really make money for their colleges. What do universities get out of having big-time football? I mean, we've just been through a whole series of conversations here about the dangers, about the scandals. What's the upside, and is the upside worth it?
Well, the upside for the university is, and I would not say this is the case at UConn, but at many universities, football is the front porch of the university, and it is a tremendous lure for students to come to those schools. It's amazing how many kids will go to Michigan or Ohio State or Penn State because of football. I'm talking about students, not football players. It's a huge marketing device. It sells an unbelievable amount of apparel, not just on campus, but around the country. And so there's a lot of things that football does from a marketing standpoint that's very helpful to a school. The misperception, though, is that they're also profiting. But the truth is that the majority of these schools, that the football teams are actually losing money because the budgets are so high. We didn't look specifically at UConn because they're not really in the kind of league that we were focusing on in the system. But I can't imagine that UConn's football team is making money. And they're not the top tier team at UConn. Basketball is. UConn's a basketball school. It always will be. It's not going to be a football school.
All right, Jeff Benedict, it's so great to talk to you. The book is League of no, that's League of Denial. That's his special. The System, the Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football. Eminently readable. Each chapter is kind of like a little short story all by itself. Thanks to everybody who helped out with today's show. Tomorrow, a show about guilt. We're going to do a little bit more fundraising right here. If you love the Colin McEnroe Show, now is a great time to make your pledge to WNPR. So, you know, don't be shy.
Nobody, not even the rain, has such small hands. And Kyone Wolfe, man, E.E. Cummings just tackles me for a first down. Yes!